The 1914 Christmas Truce and What It Means. This compilation was presented by Truth and Justice Radio's host, Bob Funk, on Christmas Eve 2017, but we believe it's timeless. Bob is a Purple Heart awarded veteran of the Vietnam War and a committed member of Veterans for Peace, Smedley D. Butler Brigade. As an aside, here are some words from decorated World War I war hero Smedley Butler's 1935 book, War is a Racket. War is a racket. It always has been. It is the only one in which the profits are reckoned in dollars and the losses in lives. You can read that book at wanttoknow.info/war-is-a-racket, all lowercase. This presentation is 46 minutes in duration. Here's Bob.
I'm going to finish off this morning with something that happened 103 years ago. And it is the Christmas Truce. A cross left at St. Eve in Belgium was left there in 1999 to commemorate the site of the Christmas Truce. Text reads, 1914, the Khaki Chums Christmas Truce to 1999, 85 years, lest we forget. When we add the rest of it together, it's now been 103 years since the Christmas Truce. In the week leading up to the holiday, French, German, and British soldiers crossed trenches to exchange seasonal greetings and talk. In some areas, men from both sides ventured into no man's land on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day to mingle and exchange food and souvenirs. There were joint burial ceremonies and prisoner swaps, while several meetings ended in carol singing. Men played games of football with one another, giving one of the most memorable images of the truce. Peaceful behavior was not ubiquitous. Fighting continued in some sectors, while in others, the sides settled down on little more than arrangements to recover bodies. The total number of military and civilian casualties in World War I was more than 38 million. There were over 17 million deaths and 20 million wounded, ranking it among the deadliest conflicts in human history. Truces were not unique to the Christmas period and reflected a growing mood of live and let live. When the infantry were close together, they would often stop overtly aggressive behavior and engage in small-scale fraternization, engaging in conversation or bartering for cigarettes. After all, you have to remember that prior to the war, and a lot of the people didn't even know why they were in this war, there was always a respect for the other individuals. The Germans didn't have anything against the French, British, or, you know, everybody kind of like got along in Europe. There were some problems, of course, but that all changed when Ferdinand and Sophie were shot and killed, and that started the ball rolling for World War I. So you have to understand that because of that, these people, they weren't sure there was actually going to be a war. So they would go back and forth and, you know, take care of things, and eventually a few people would get shot, and they went out and they cleaned up the area. So it came down to live and let live. Fraternization, peaceful and sometimes friendly interactions between opposing forces, was a regular feature on quiet front line sectors of the Western Front. In some areas, it manifested simply as a passive inactivity, where both sides would refrain from overtly aggressive or threatening behavior, while in other cases it extended to regular conversation or even visits from one trench to the other. Truces between British and German units can be dated to early November 1914, around the time opposing armies had become static trench warfare. At this time, both sides' rations were brought up to the front line after dusk, and soldiers on both sides noted a period of peace where they collected their food. By December 1st, a British soldier could record a friendly visit from a German sergeant one morning to see how we were getting on. Relations between the French and German units were generally more tense, but the same phenomenon began to emerge. In early December, a German surgeon recorded a half-hour truce each evening to recover the dead soldiers for burial, during which French and German soldiers exchanged newspapers. This behavior was often challenged by both junior and senior officers. The young Charles de Gaulle wrote on 7 December 1914 of the lamentable desire of French infantrymen to leave the enemy in peace, while the commander of the 10th Army, Victor Dubelle, wrote of the unfortunate consequences when men become familiar with their neighbors opposite. Other truces could be enforced on both sides by weather conditions, especially when trench lines flooded in low-lying areas, though these often lasted only till the weather cleared. The proximity of trench lines made it easy for soldiers to shout greetings to each other, and this may have been most common method of arranging informal truces during 1914. Men would frequently exchange news or greetings, helped by a common language. Many German soldiers had lived in England, particularly London, and were familiar with the language and the culture. Several British soldiers recorded instances of Germans asking about news from the football leagues, while other conversations could be as banal as discussions of the weather or plaintive as messages for a sweetheart. One unusual phenomenon that grew in intensity was music. In peaceful sectors, it was not uncommon for units to sing in the evenings, sometimes deliberately, with an eye towards entertaining or gently taunting their opposite numbers. This shaded gently into a more festive activity. In early December, Sir Edmund Hulse of the Scots Guards wrote that he was planning to organize a concert party for Christmas Day, which would give the enemy every conceivable form of song and harmony, in response to frequent choruses of Deutschland über alles. British and German troops, meeting in no man's land during the unofficial truce, British troops from the Northumberland Hussars, 7th Division, Bridon Rouge Bank Sector. Roughly 100,000 British and German troops were involved in the unofficial cessations of hostilities along the Western Front. The first truce started on Christmas Eve, 1914, when German troops decorated the area around their trenches in the region of Ypres, Belgium, particularly at St. Yvonne, where Captain Bruce Bairnsfather described the truce. The Germans placed candles on their trenches and on Christmas trees, then continued the celebration by singing Christmas carols. The British responded by singing carols of their own. The two sides continued by shouting Christmas greetings to each other. Soon thereafter, there were excursions across no man's land where small gifts were exchanged, such as food, tobacco, alcohol, souvenirs such as buttons and hats. The artillery of the region fell silent. The truce also allowed a breathing spell where recently killed soldiers could be brought back behind their lines by burial parties. Joint services were held. In many sectors, the truce lasted through Christmas night, continuing until New Year's Day in others. On the day itself, Brigadier General Walter Congreve, then commanding the 18th Infantry Brigade, stationed near Neuville-Chapelle, wrote a letter recalling the Germans initiated by calling a truce for the day. One of the brigade's men bravely lifted his head above the parapet, and others from both sides walked into no man's land. Officers and men shook hands and exchanged cigarettes and cigars. One of the captains smoked a cigar with the best shot in the German army, the latter no more than 18 years old. Congreve admitted he was reluctant to personally witness the scene of the truce for fear he would be a prime target for German snipers. Bruce Bairn's father, who served throughout the war, wrote, "I wouldn't have missed that unique and weird Christmas day for anything. I spotted a German officer, some sort of lieutenant, I should think, and being a bit of a collector, I intimated to him that I had taken a fancy to some of his buttons. I brought out my wild clippers and, with a few deft snips, removed a couple of his buttons and put them in my pocket. I then gave him two of mine in exchange. The last I saw was one of my machine gunners, who was a bit of an amateur hairdresser in civil life, cutting the unnaturally long hair of a docile German who was patiently kneeling on the ground whilst the automatic clippers crept up the back of his neck." Future Nature writer Henry Williamson, then a 19-year-old private in the London Rifle Brigade, wrote to his mother on Boxing Day, "Dear Mother, I am writing from the trenches. It's 11 o'clock in the morning. Besides me is a coke fire. Opposite me a dugout, wet, with straw in it. The ground is sloppy in the actual trench, but frozen elsewhere. In my mouth is a pipe presented by the Princess Mary. In the pipe is tobacco. Of course, you say, but wait. The pipe is German tobacco. Ha ha, you say, from a prisoner found in a captured trench. Oh dear, no. From a German soldier. Yes, a live German soldier from his own trench yesterday. The British and Germans met and shook hands in the ground between the trenches and exchanged souvenirs and shook hands. Yes, all day, Christmas Day, and as I write. Marvelous, isn't it?" Captain Sir Edward Hulse reported how the first interpreter he met from the German lines was from Suffolk, where he had left his girlfriend and the 3.5-horsepower motorcycle. Hulse went on to describe a sing-song which ended up with Auld Lang Syne, which we all, English, Scots, Irish, Prussians, Württembergers, etc., joined in. It was absolutely astounding, and it was as I had seen it on a film. I should have sworn it was faked. Friday, Christmas Day, we were having the most extraordinary Christmas Day imaginable, a sort of unarranged and quite unauthorized but perfectly understood, scrupulously observed truce exists between us and our friends in front. The funny thing is, it only seems to exist in this part of the battle line. On our right and left, we can hear all of them firing away cheerfully as ever. The thing started last night, a bitter cold night with white frost. Soon after dusk, when the Germans started shouting, 'Merry Christmas, Englishmen,' to us, of course, our fellows shouted back, and presently, large numbers on both sides had left their trenches unarmed and met in the debatable, shot-riddled no-man's land between the lines. Here the agreement, all on their own, came to be made that we should not fire at each other until after midnight tonight. The men were all fraternizing in the middle. We naturally did not allow them too close to our line and swapped cigarettes and lies in the utmost good fellowship. Not a shot was fired all night. Of the Germans, he wrote, they are distinctly bored with the war. In fact, one of them wanted to know what on earth we were doing here fighting them. The truce in that sector continued into Boxing Day. He commented about the Germans. The beggars simply disregard all our warnings to get down from off the parapet. So things are at a deadlock. We can't shoot them in cold blood. I don't see how we can get them to return to business. On Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, 24 and 25 December 1914, Alfred Anderson's unit of the 1st and 5th Battalion of the Black Watch was billeted in a farmhouse away from the front line. In a later interview in 2003, Anderson, the last known surviving Scottish veteran of the war, vividly recalled Christmas Day and said, I remember the silence, the eerie sound of silence. Only the guards were on duty. We all went outside the farm buildings and just stood listening. And of course, thinking of people back home. All I heard for 2 months in the trenches was the hissing, crackling, and whining of bullets in flight, machine gun fire, and distant German voices. But there was a dead silence that morning, right across the land, as far as you could see. We shouted, Merry Christmas, even though nobody felt merry. The silence ended early in the afternoon, and the killing started again. It was a short peace in a terrible war. Nor were the observations confined to the British. French Lieutenant Johannes Niemann wrote, Grab my binoculars and looking cautiously over the parapet, saw the incredible sight of our soldiers exchanging cigarettes, schnapps, and chocolate with the enemy. General Sir Horace Smith Dorrien, commander of the British Second Corps, issued orders forbidding friendly communication with the opposing German troops. Adolf Hitler, then a young corporal in the 16th Bavarian Reserve Infantry, was also an opponent of the truce. In the Comines section of the front, there was an early fraternization between German and French soldiers in December 1914 during a short truce, and there are at least two other testimonials from French soldiers of similar behaviors in sectors where German and French companies opposed each other. Gervais Morillon wrote to his parents, The Germans waved a white flag and shouted, Kamerads, kamerads, rendezvous. When we didn't move, they came towards us, unarmed, led by an officer. Although we are not clean, they are disgustingly filthy. I am telling you this, but don't speak of it to anyone. We must not mention it, even to other soldiers. Gustave Berthier wrote, On Christmas Day, the Germans made a sign showing they wished to speak to us. They said they didn't want to shoot. They were tired of making war. They were married, like me. They didn't have any differences with the French, but with the English. In sections of the front where German and Belgian troops faced each other in December 1914, there was at least one such instance when a truce was achieved at the request of Belgian soldiers who wished to send letters back to their families over the German-occupied parts of their own country. Richard Sherman, who was a German was in a German regiment holding a position on Bernhardstein, one of the mountains of the Vorsee, wrote in an account of events in December 1915, when the Christmas bells sounded in the villages of the Vosges behind the lines, something fantastically unmilitary occurred. German and French troops spontaneously made peace and ceased hostilities. They visited each other through disused trench tunnels and exchanged wine, cognac, cigarettes for Westphalian black bread, biscuits, and ham. This suited them so well that they remained good friends even after Christmas was over. He was separated from the French troops by a narrow no man's land and described the landscape as strewn with shattered trees, the ground plowed up by shell fire, a wilderness of earth, tree roots, tattered uniforms. Military discipline was soon restored, but Sherman pondered over the incident and whether thoughtful young people of all countries could be provided with suitable meeting places where they could get to know each other. He went on to found the German Youth Hostel Association in 1919. Football matches. Many accounts of the truce involve one or more football matches played in no man's land. This was mentioned in some of the earliest reports with a letter written by a doctor attached to the Rifle Brigade. Published in the Times on 1 January 1915, reported a football match played between them and us in front of the trench. A wide range of similar stories have been told over the years, often naming specific units or a precise score. Some accounts of the game bring in elements of fiction by Robert Graves, a British poet and writer who reconstructed the encounter in a story published in 1962. In Graves's version, the score was 3-2 to the Germans. However, the truth of the accounts has been disputed by some historians. In 1984, Malcolm Brown and Shirley Seaton concluded that there were probably attempts to play organized matches which failed due to the state of the ground. But the contemporary reports were either hearsay or referred to kickabout matches with made-up footballs, such as a bully beef tin. Chris Baker, a former chairman of the Western Front Association and author of The Truce, The Day the War Stopped, is also skeptical, but says that although there is little hard evidence, the most likely place that an organized match could have taken place was near the village of Messinas. There are two references to a game being played on the British side, but nothing from the Germans. If somebody one day found a letter from a German soldier who was in that area, then we would have something credible. In fact, there is a reference. Lieutenant Kurt Jemis of Germany's 134th Saxons Infantry Regiment said that the English brought a soccer ball from their trenches, and pretty soon a lively game ensued. How marvelously wonderful, how strange it was. In 2011, Mike Dash concluded that there is plenty of evidence that football was played that Christmas Day, mostly by men of the same nationality, but in at least four places between troops of the opposing armies. A wide variety of units were reported in contemporary accounts to have taken part in the games. Dash listed the 133rd Royal Saxon Regiment pitched against the Scottish troops, the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders against unidentified Germans, the Scots reported to have won 4-1. The Royal Field Artillery against Prussians and Hanovers near Ypres, and the Lancashire Fusiliers, based near Le Touquet, with the specific detail of bully beef ration tin being the ball. One recent writer has identified 29 separate reports of football, though does not give substantive details. On the Eastern Front, a separate manifestation of the Christmas truce of December 1914 occurred on the Eastern Front, where the first move originated from the Austria-Hungary commanders at some uncertain level of the military hierarchy. The Russians responded positively, and the soldiers eventually met in no man's land. The events of the truce were not reported for a week. In an unofficial press embargo, which was eventually broken by the New York Times, published in the then-neutral United States on 31 December. The British papers quickly followed, printing numerous first-hand accounts from soldiers in the field, taken from letters home to their families and editorials on one of the greatest surprises of a surprising war. By 8 January, pictures had made their way to the press, and both the Mirror and Sketch printed front-page photographs of British and German troops mingling and singing between the lines. The tone of the reporting was strongly positive, with the Times endorsing the lack of malice felt by both sides, and the Mirror regretting that the absurdity and the tragedy would begin again. Coverage in Germany was more muted, with some newspapers strongly criticizing those who had taken part, and no pictures published. In France, meanwhile, the greater level of press censorship ensured that the only word that spread of the truth came from soldiers at the front, or first-hand accounts told by wounded men in hospitals. The press was eventually forced to respond to the growing rumors by reprinting a government notice that fraternizing with the enemy constituted treason. And in early January, an official statement on the truce was published, claiming that it had happened on restricted sections of the British front and amounted to little more than an exchange of songs, which quickly degenerated into shooting. British and German troops buried the bodies of those killed in the attack of 18 December. After Christmas 1914, sporadic attempts were made at seasonal truces. A German unit attempted to leave their trenches under a flag of truce on Easter Sunday 1915, but were warned off by the British officer then. And later in the year, in November, a Saxon unit briefly fraternized with a Liverpool battalion. In December, January 15th, there were explicit orders by the Allied commanders to forestall any repeat of the previous Christmas truce. Individual units were encouraged to mount raids, harass the enemy line, whilst communicating with the enemy was discouraged by artillery barrages along the front line throughout the day. The prohibition was not completely effective, however, and a small number of brief truces occurred. An eyewitness account of one truce was by Llewellyn Wynne Griffin, recorded that after a night of exchanging carols, dawn on Christmas Day saw a rush of men from both sides and a feverish exchange of souvenirs. Before the men were quickly called back by their officers, with offers to hold a ceasefire for the day and play a football match. It came to nothing, as the brigade commander threatened repercussions for the lack of discipline and insisted on resumption of firing in the afternoon. Another member of Griffith's battalion, Bertie Felstead, later recalled that one man had produced a football, resulting in a free-for-all. There could have been 50 on each side before we were ordered back. In an adjacent center, a short truce to bury the dead between the lines led to official repercussions. A company commander, Sir Ian Colquhoun of the Scots Guards, was court-martialed for defying standing orders to the contrary. While he was found guilty and reprimanded, the punishment was annulled by General Haig, and Colquhoun remained in his position. The official leniency may perhaps have been because he was related to H.H. Asquith, the Prime Minister. In the Decembers of 1916 and 1917, German overtures to the British for truces were recorded without any success. In some French sectors, singing in an exchange of thrown gifts was occasionally recorded, though these may have simply reflected a seasonal extension of the live-and-let-live approach common in the trenches. At Easter 1915, there were recorded instances of truces between Orthodox troops of opposing sides on the Eastern Front. The Bulgarian writer Yordan Yavkov, serving as an officer near the Greek border at the Mester River, witnessed one such truce. It inspired his short story, Holy Night, translated into English in 2013 by Krastu Banyev. British and German descendants of Great War veterans, although the popular tendency has been to see December 1914 Christmas truces as unique and therefore of romantic rather than political significance, they have also been interpreted as part of the widespread non-cooperation with the war spirit and conduct by serving soldiers. In his book on trench warfare, historian Tony Ashworth describes what he calls the live-and-let-live system, complicated local truces and agreements not to fire at each other were developed by men along the front throughout the war. These often began with agreement not to attack each other at tea, meal, or washing times, and in some places became so developed that whole sections of the front would see few casualties for extended periods of time. This system, Ashworth argues, gave soldiers some control over the conditions of their existence. The December 1914 truce, Christmas truces, then can be seen as not unique, but as the most dramatic example of non-cooperation with the war spirit that included refusal to fight, unofficial truces, mutinies, strikes, and peace protests. Good for them. The total numbers of deaths includes about 11 million military personnel and about 7 million civilians. The Triple Entente, also known as the Allies, lost about 6 million military personnel, while the Central Powers lost about 4 million. At least 2 million died from disease, and 6 million went missing, presumed dead. This article lists the casualties of the belligerent powers based on official published sources. About two-thirds of military deaths in World War I were in battle, unlike the conflicts that took place in the 19th century when a majority of deaths were due to disease. Nevertheless, disease, including the 1918 flu pandemic and deaths while held as POWs, still caused about one-third of the total military deaths for all belligerents. So what we see, and I have one more short piece right after this, after I make this comment. As one soldier, I can understand how these men felt. If you cross the line and you find out that you were a wheat farmer and the guy who was shooting at you 5 minutes ago was a potato farmer, you have something in common. It's the earth and something that you don't want to go into, which is the earth. So looking at these guys, I mean, thinking about how they, on their own, decided to have a truce and could have ended the war right there in 1914 on Christmas Eve. Of course, those who never have to fight the war, who have all the brass and the medals and the stupid hats and yad furs and people that shine their boots and all this other junk, that never actually had to go out into the mud and slime and no man's land and cross over barbed wire and get blown to bits by huge artillery shells or have their eyes or lungs burned out by mustard gas or some other horrific situation. The Sturmgewehr, which went in with flamethrowers. We have to understand that World War I, or the Great War, actually, was the first fully industrialized war the world had ever seen. It was fought on sea, land, in the air, under the sea. Supplies came from thousands of miles away. Individuals to fight came from literally around the world. The British Empire had Sikhs and Indians, and the French had French Somalis and numerous and sundry other groups. The Italians allied with the French and British and United States. And by the time we got there, the war had soured to the point where there was going to be no quarter given. It was over. Occasionally, there would be a grandiose item that popped up. It would be as if you found the letters of someone, an enemy soldier, in their helmet, and they were dead on no man's land. And you could get them over to the trenches so they could be sent home. That happened on all sides as well. So there we have an incredible amount of people that did not want to fight. There was no real reason for the war. And it changed the world. And because of the Treaty of Versailles, it set up an even more horrific war some 20 years later. Now, this is something I brought up on Armistice Day a few years ago. The last American killed in the Great War, Henry Nicholas John Gunther, June 6th, 1895, to November 11th, 1918, was an American soldier and the last soldier of any of the belligerents to be killed during World War I. He was killed at 10:59 a.m., 1 minute before the armistice was to take effect at 11 a.m. Gunther's unit, Company A, arrived at the Western Front on September 12th, 1918. Like all Allied units on the front of the Meuse-Argonne offensive, it was still embroiled in fighting on the morning of the 11th. The armistice with Germany was signed by 5 a.m. local time, but it would not come into force until 11 a.m. Gunther's squad approached a roadblock of two German machine guns in the villas of Chaumont-Damvillers near Meuse in Lorraine. Gunther got up against orders of his close friend and now Sergeant Ernest Powell and charged with his bayonet. The German soldiers, already aware of the armistice that would take effect in 1 minute, tried to wave Gunther off. He kept going and fired a shot or two. When he got too close to the machine gunners, he was shot with a short burst of automatic fire and killed instantly. The writer James M. McCain, then a reporter for the local daily newspaper, The Sun, interviewed Gunther's comrades afterward and wrote that Gunther brooded a great deal over his recent reduction in the rank and became obsessed with the determination to make good before his officers and fellow soldiers. American Expeditionary Forces commanding General John J. Pershing's order of the day on the following day specifically mentioned Gunther as the last American killed in the war. The Army posthumously restored his rank of sergeant, awarded him the Divisional Citation for Gallantry in Action, and the Distinguished Service Cross. Henry Nichols John Gunther, June 6, 1895, November 11, 1918, an American soldier, last soldier of any belligerents to be killed during World War I. His remains were returned to the United States in 1923 after being exhumed from a military cemetery in France and buried in the Most Holy Redeemer Cemetery in Baltimore. The last American soldier from World War I, whose name was Frank Buckles. He died some 3 years ago at the age of 107. And so ended another war by his death. And I just wish we could all learn like those men of 1914 on Christmas Eve that we are all brothers and sisters in this world and we don't need to have a war. So, with all of that said, my name is Bob Funk. You have been listening to 4 hours of spirited examination of war making, empire, corrupt justice, engineered poverty, lying politicians, jingoism, corporate criminality, and media disinformation. Any views expressed do not necessarily reflect those of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. I'd like to thank you for listening to Truth and Justice Radio. We're here every Sunday from 6 to 10. Actually, I get started at about 5. I'm going to take us out with a song. It's by a young lady known as Fenya, and it's called The Christmas Truce. If you listen closely, and she's got a beautiful voice. Don't forget to perform a random act of kindness, and after this song, it'll be Sunday Morning Country with Country Vic. Here we go with Fenya.
Every soldier, every sailor, every airman, no matter what part of the military they join, this is the key part. Obey orders without question.
You don't fight and we won't fight. We can sleep in peace this Christmas night. The war is over by the truce decree. to dead end fight, and we all agree. What are we gonna do come the morning light? You don't fight and we won't fight. We can meet halfway on the bloody ice. Comradely bonds with no arms drawn. I'm wondering whose side we're on. Got a flask of something strong and I'm sharing it with friends tonight. You don't fight, we won't fight. Can bury our dead and honor them right. I'll pray for you and you'll pray for me. And we'll redefine bravery. I'm strong and I'm proud, but I ain't gonna take a lie. You don't fight and we won't fight. I got half your man right in my sight. But I've seen your lives and I've seen your day. So I'm aiming right above your head. The world's gone mad, but I ain't gonna take a lie. You don't fight and we won't fight. What's courage last past Christmas night? What'll they say in 100 years when they look back on what happened here? What are we gonna do come the morning light? What are we gonna do come the morning light?
You start to realise that actually the history that you've been taught, the stories that you've heard, they're one side of the story. And then it's not just the war in Iraq or the war in Afghanistan, it's the whole lot of it.